Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
This morning, I'd like to introduce our guest speaker, Eric Storley. Eric is one of the founders of Minnesota Zen Meditation Center. He practiced in California and then practiced here with me for a long time. And he is one of the people who brought Katagiri Roshi here. His book, which has been in bookstores for years, Nothing on My Mind, talks about his practice and his work with two teachers and his life when he was a young man. He's working on another book now. He's almost finished another book, which is more autobiographical, I think. Is that right, Eric?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Let's see, what else about Eric that you should know? He still lives in the neighborhood. He and I both moved in this neighborhood because we knew that they were in long, long time ago. We bought this building in 1975. And first I moved into the neighborhood and then Eric moved in. I actually helped you move into your house, Eric.
Oh, okay.
He doesn't remember. He's even older than I am.
Yeah, yeah. Not that much.
Oh. And he teaches Zen and Zen meditation at the Center for Spirituality at the University of Minnesota, where he has for some years. He did his dissertation on Dogen and the Puritans many years ago, and I remember reading his dissertation and being very impressed. So, welcome, Eric.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you all for coming. Well, Tim, almost 68, but not quite. Well, I think I'm getting my cold this fall, so pardon me for sneezing so loudly during Zazen about half an hour ago. It woke me up, so it may have had some benefit. And Tim, thanks for inviting me here. Although Tim and I both practiced in San Francisco with Suzuki Roshi, he was ahead of me a few years down at Stanford. So I didn't get to know him and Linda until about the time Bob Persig was doing the lecture to raise funds for this building. And we drove all over the Twin Cities putting up posters promoting Persig's lecture. So somewhere in 75, I remember sitting on the porch with the Persigs and debating whether to buy this building. And the sun was coming in from the west. It was a beautiful sunset and golden light all through that porch. So we thought, oh, this is cool. We'll do it. And we did it because Bob Persig made a lot of money on Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And they gave 20,000 toward the purchase of 60,000. So you can see there's an inflation factor in housing from 1975 to the present, but now it's backing down. So. Well, as I came up here this morning, I noticed a sail, what do they call those boards out on the lake? The sail. Sailboard?
Windsurfers.
And I thought, how cool. I've never done that, but I thought, that's really cool. You know, this is the samadhi of wind, waves, cold, hanging on, going fast. And I envied this guy. Except for maybe the cold weather. But he had a good wetsuit on. But what I'd like to talk about this morning is what Dogen calls the samadhi of samadhis, which is what we were doing 30 minutes ago, 10 minutes ago. So you can have that wonderful samadhi or oneness, being in the flow, being in the zone, as some of the people in athletics call it, on a windsurfer or working a soccer ball through a game. The great player Pele has a description of his being in the zone as a soccer player where he's in bliss. And he feels like he can actually move through people. He's totally there. And you've all had this experience in something. It could be the piano. It could be basketball. It could be engrossed in a great film or book. Just that complete oneness, no distractions, time stops. And we've all had it as children. And as I recall, one of the stories about the Buddha is that his earliest awakening was as a child in the garden, feeling suddenly, this is beautiful, this is enough. This is it. So as children, we've had it playing. That play where when finally mother calls for dinner, suddenly a spell is broken, time has not been there, and reluctantly you go in. So just no problem. No problem. But it's much harder to do that, is it not, without an object. A windsurfer, a little boat to float, a soccer ball, a piano, a guitar, a book. So, in some sense, what we're doing here is that samadhi of samadhis, or that oneness of onenesses, or that being in the flow of being in the flow. Being aware of being aware, as opposed to having the object. And in all other activities except this simple sitting down, we have an object. Could be Tai Chi, it could be Qigong, it could be focusing on our mantra, it could be becoming devotional to a deity, it could be roller skating. But we have an object. So in the practice that Dogen calls practice enlightenment, just one thing, not an end, means to an end, no object. Except when we sit here, all sorts of thoughts, emotions, calculations, plans, conversations with our partner, maybe a good conversation, maybe a bad conversation. Memories of nice things people said about us, memories of nasty things people said, all those things come rising up in the field of awareness. Am I right? Or are you all beyond that stage now? Okay, so some of you at least are still having those awarenesses rising up. But in this sitting, we simply register that. And that's different from, let's say, very valid work where you take toxic thoughts and emotions and try to understand and work with them, which is good and necessary. But in this practice, we can just be here. And then objects rise, thought objects rise, and we, our effort is to recognize that those are, this is this mind giving rise to this mind. Or as Dogen describes, going from an old story, reality or Buddha Dharma, simply the one bright pearl, one bright pearl. Everything is one bright pearl. So even the toxic, angering thought is one bright pearl. So then what? That's a problem. What do you do? Well, in some sense, I think we digest it. We digest it. So there's a lot of digestion that can go on as we get grounded and simply try to be here. So I asked him simply to say, as a title to the talk, 44 years of Zazen, because I thought that might be impressive. You know. But when I mentioned that to my wife, she said, well, hasn't helped that much. So, you know, it's always the intimate partner who has a much more realistic take on how things are going in your spiritual practice. But, you know, she didn't know me in my 20s and 30s, which is a good thing. We certainly wouldn't be together. So my only job here would be to just encourage you to hang in there. I mean, it's a very austere practice. And it's not like if I'd played the piano for 44 years. I mean, I've spent thousands of hours literally looking at these walls in this building over the time that we bought it. If I'd spent that much time on the piano, I could at least be getting some money at a piano bar in downtown Minneapolis. You know, there would be something demonstrable. I could juggle a soccer ball. I could paint a better picture, etc. So, of course, Dogen says we're not doing this as a means to an end. So the end should not matter. This is goalless. On the other hand, you all got up this morning and came here impelled by a natural human wish to experience something, to move in some direction. So the subtitle of my talk should have simply been, hang in there. Don't stop. Keep going. Do it. And that led me to Dogen's... incidentally, Tim, I brought you a copy of my book for the library in case it's been stolen by an eager Zen student. Oh, they're on my... See there now. That's perfect. That's mindfulness. Pure mindfulness. So I just saw a wonderful quote from Goethe where he says, we are all seeking the horse we're already riding on. Or in the Zen tradition, it would be the ox. We're all looking for the ox that we're always riding on. But when Dogen came back from China, his first little piece, Fukan Zazengi, was basically telling people, for God's sake, start doing Zazen again. And one of my favorite, I'll read you one of my favorite paragraphs. This is the Waddell and Abe collection of pieces from the Shobogenzu. And I love the language. It's good English. Many translations of these things are awful English. They may be accurate, but... So Dogen goes through the description of spread out a layer of thick matting and place a cushion on it and so on and so forth. All the things that you learn here. And then your eyes should always remain open. Breathe gently through your nose. Once you have adjusted yourself into this posture, take a deep breath. Inhale, exhale, rock your body to the right and left, and settle into a steady, unmoving, sitting position. Think of not thinking. Well, that's helpful. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This is the essential art of Zazen. So, that's wonderful because it's no answer, but it points to something about our relationship to thought. And, of course, as soon as a thought arises, it's like Brer Rabbit's tar baby. We get stuck to it. Thoughts are very sticky. And so there's a hint of advice here just about releasing those thoughts and emotions as they arise. Experiencing what's underneath. Experiencing the mind that's giving rise to thoughts. So, in a period of Zazen, often we can have thought, emotion, whatever. And kind of go unconscious between each thought. And then at some point, often in a retreat setting, we may notice, oh, between the thoughts, I'm still here. I'm still here. Yeah. And then at some point we may notice a thought trying to be born, rising up, knocking at the door of consciousness. And that awareness can settle the thought, settle the mind. So, think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. And then he goes on to the paradox. The Zazen I speak of is not learning meditation. It is simply the Dharma gate of repose and bliss. It is the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. It is things as they are in suchness. No traps or snares can ever reach it. Once its heart is grasped, you are like the dragon when he reaches the water, like the tiger when he enters the mountain. Well, that sounds kind of absolute. I've certainly done a lot of sitting where I didn't feel like I was the tiger that had entered the mountain or the dragon that had found the water. And that's discouraging. Of course. So, staying with it is the only possibility for moving beyond those times when we're quite naturally discouraged. We don't see the goal, the result, the accomplishment we want. We're not experiencing. We aren't feeling like we've entered the Dharma gate of repose and bliss. Bliss, in my head, is an argument between me and my boss. In my head is a memory of a toxic relationship. In my head is an endless debate about what I should do in the future. Sure, Yeah, that's all. That's all there. It's all there. And I think what people like Tim and I can offer is just encouragement. Sure, that's there. But also the release is there. It's not what I fantasized back in my 20s, where since I came out of the culture of the magical plants and substances in Berkeley in the 60s, I assumed that after a certain, probably rather short period of time, I would be fully enlightened with Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert and others. And people would bow, and I would be in bliss, and all of my various toxicities would have been resolved. Passport stamped through the gate of bliss and repose. Everything would be cool. And no such luck. But, you know, that's fine. That was how the West, starting with the generation, really, that comes before Tim and me, people like Gary Snyder, who is now in his pushing 80, you know, that generation of Americans, Snyder and Ginsburg, really looked at Eastern thought and opened up a trail. And here we are with various meditation centers in town, different traditions, and it's available. It's available. And Tim and I, of course, are he less than I, getting old and tired. So it's up to you all to keep sitting with great determination to carry this forward. But not for a goal, right? Just to do it. So encouragement, of course, the word comes from the Latin core for heart. So it's putting heart into this practice, which, as I say, is very austere and can be very dry and lonely. So communities like this are invaluable, where people can connect and work together and support each other. But since it's so difficult to describe this samadhi of samadhis, this oneness of oneness, or this being in the flow of just being in the flow, what seems to work best is poetry. If we're going to use words, we use poetry. I mean, there are logical attempts to describe this, so I can say something like, in this sitting, we can be aware of awareness, or we can enter the flow of being in the flow. Well, what the hell does that mean? So much of the teaching and writing about this tries to convey something in language that's not logical. So I pulled out a few representatives for you. So one of my favorites is Dogen's image of the moon and the dewdrop, which many of you would be familiar with. But let me just read that again. The attainment of enlightenment is like the moon reflected on the water. The moon does not get wet, and the surface of the water is not broken. For all the breadth and vastness of its light, the moon comes to rest in a small patch of water. The whole moon and the sky in its entirety come to rest in a single dewdrop on a grass tip, a mere pinpoint of water. Enlightenment does not destroy man or woman any more than the moon makes a hole on the surface of the water. Men and women do not obstruct enlightenment any more than the drop of dew obstructs the moon or the heavens. The depth of the one will be the measure of the other's heights. As for the time, the quickness or slowness of enlightenment's coming. Well, this is our old question, you know. How soon will I enter the Dharma gate of bliss and repose? I'm a busy person. I can't waste any more time here. Maybe I need to get a special magical mantra that will move me more quickly in that direction. The trouble with Zen is it's just, you might say, practical magic. There's no emphasis on supernatural and magical power that will allow Tim to take on your karma so that you move more quickly. And, oh, he would be delighted. So we're stuck, you know. The miracles in Zen, as many stories say, are, well, my throat is dry, I drink water. I open my hand and the book drops. Gravity. No one understands gravity. No one understands consciousness. It's beyond. So, so I love Dogen's response to, as for the time, the quickness or slowness of enlightenment's coming, you must carefully scrutinize the quantity of the water. Well, how big is the ocean? How big is Lake Calhoun? Survey the extent of the moon and the sky. So this beautiful image, you know, we're the pinpoint of water on the end of the blade of grass. And we reflect the moon. We reflect the whole universe. Every time you look at Lake Calhoun, suddenly you're a mile deep. You're holding that perception. If you look at the Pacific Ocean, you are the Pacific Ocean. It's coming in through your retina. The images are flipped upside down on the back, or coming in through the lens, upside down on the retina, going through the optic nerves, into the visual cortex. Pacific Ocean, somewhere here. But it's also out there. It's a paradox. It's a mystery. Dualism, but it's one. So Dogen and other predecessors in Buddhism and Hinduism love the image of the reflection, of the mirror, of the way in which each of us is a living mirror of the universe. So we look at the Milky Way, and it is with us, it's in us, it is us, and yet it's also there. And nothing is broken. The moon does not get wet, and the surface of the water is not broken. The whole moon and the sky in its entirety come to rest in a single dewdrop on a grass tip. A mere pinpoint of water. Enlightenment does not destroy man or woman any more than the moon makes a hole on the surface of the water. Men or women do not obstruct enlightenment any more than the drop of dew obstructs the moon or the heavens. The depth of the one will be the measure of the other's height. So it often helps to take your meditation outside, into the wild, into wilderness. Get long views. Don't just look at the wall. Be outside. Get that natural wild beauty that you can find even in a city park to register inside, and then reverberate against that, what Natalie Goldberg calls the wild mind inside, that's often layered over by all of our self-concerns. Useful self-concerns often, necessary, but we can easily become driven and obsessed by them. And Zazen is a place where we can digest that and make some space, open up some space. Katagiri used to say that lectures were like candy. They just, you know, Zazen is too hard, so periodically you've got to attract the intellect and give some candy to the children, make them think they're getting somewhere, learning something. And he used to enrage Beverly White, who Katagiri would give a lecture here and say, well, Zazen is really useless. And Beverly, who probably was younger than I am now, but seemed like a very old lady when I was in my 30s, hated that because it would discourage people. And maybe it did. I don't know. So we need to encourage, I think. Give heart. But then it's a trap to do Zazen thinking about the outcome for tomorrow. That's, we do it, of course, we do it. But as those thoughts, that spiritual materialism, how many billions of merits will I have accumulated after 44 years of practice? And the answer, as was given to Emperor Wu in the famous old story, no merit, nothing. Eric, you're just going to die. It's okay. Forget about it. But do Zazen. Be here. Give yourself the space and time to actually live in this moment without running after an object, without having to accomplish something. Just sitting down and living for a time. There's a wonderful story that I just came across. I noticed before where supposedly after the Buddha twirled the flower that Mahakashyapa smiled at, and the Buddha said, ah, you got it. I think the translation is much fancier. But you got it. And someone said, huh? What happened? And the Buddha said, well, this was like, I've got to get that quote right. It's kind of, he said, well, who knows what he, no one knows what he said, but they say he said, in this instance, it's even worse than Jesus, where so much distance between us and the actual voice has come into play. But my preaching for more than 50 years may be likened to saying there is something in your hand. In order to bring near a small child, you want to take into your arms. that make sense? My preaching is like saying, here, Johnny, come see what's in my hand. There's nothing. But Johnny comes over and you get to hug him. So essentially the Buddha is saying words. Words don't do it. Words are just a way for me to embrace my fellow humans and say, sit down, relax. As Mayor Baba said, don't worry, be happy. But it's hard work, isn't it? Not worrying and being happy. Well, here's another poetic attempt to talk about this. This is Kabir. And it's interesting that people like Kabir and particularly Rumi, the great Sufi poet, are now among the most sold books in the country. And you might ask why they sell so much better than Zen. And some of it is the language and the emotion. I like that statement from the Buddha because of that emotional feeling of, child, come close. Let's snuggle. You know, it's very warm. And much of the sutras are very cold. They're pointing at something very austere, which is both austere and very warm. So Kabir, this is Bly's translation of this clay jug. Inside this clay jug, there are canyons and pine mountains, and the maker of canyons and pine mountains. Well, now the clay jug, of course, is this clay, this body. And the Sufis and the the Muslim writers love the image of the potter and the potter's wheel and the pots. And we're the pots, and God is the potter. But he's kind of careless. He's always throwing pots that are misshapen, big nose, balding, pots that are cracked. You know, we've got a society filled with people who are working with cracks in the pot. It's there. But the clay jug is you and me. Inside this clay jug, there are canyons and pine mountains, and the maker of canyons and pine mountains. Lake Calhoun is inside each of your clay jugs. And of course, when Kabir says, and the maker of canyons and pine mountains, he's at risk of losing his head, because that's heresy. You know, Allah is not inside here in the traditional Muslim way of thinking, or the Christian either, except for the mystics. All seven oceans are inside, and the hundreds of millions of stars, all inside. The acid that tests gold is there. The acid that tests gold is in here. We don't have to go to the guru or the professor or the psychologist or the psychiatrist. Not that they can't all be useful, but the final test of your gold is in here. The acid that tests gold is there, and the one who judges jewels. In the music from the strings, no one touches. So at one point, Kabir talks about this body as a lute, a guitar. And the sources of all water. If you want the truth, I will tell you the truth. Friend, listen. The God whom I love is inside. So that's another way of talking about just sitting here. Oneness. And then we may have a whole platoon of voices in our heads when we sit down. Sure. And we have to acknowledge them. Hi there. This morning, my mother, who's been dead since 1994, reminded me that I was putting on a brown belt, but I had a black turtleneck. So her voice is there in my head. That's fine. That's fine. I have to remember that because just weeks before she died, knowing she was there, about a month before she died, and she knew she was dying, and she was quite cheerful about that because she was pushing 90 and sick of her decrepit old body. So we're going up downtown to see a lawyer to get affairs in order, and I'm standing there at the elevator, and she looks at me and says, "Eric, you're not wearing a belt again." I said, "Yeah, yeah." So I hope when you're teaching, you wear a belt. So, you know, that's cool. I enjoy that voice. I enjoy that voice. You know, then I've got voices that I don't enjoy. But, you know, kind of like, I hate this image because it's associated with Reagan, but there's a point where as you practice, there's some Teflon that develops where the sticky, toxic thoughts don't have to command your attention for the next 2, 5, 10 minutes, or day, or week. So there's a kind of the energy of attention itself creates a kind of crucible in which these thoughts can be consumed. But then we're getting kind of goal-oriented, aren't we? You know, I'm going to go to the next retreat and I will be psychologically healthy afterwards. Well, you look at the history of Zen centers, and boy, I don't know. It's a risk. You don't want to just rely on that one. So maybe it's enough just to encourage each other, hearten each other, because at bottom we have thousands of years of human history and accounts going back through Hinduism and Buddhism, or Buddhism to Hinduism to prehistory, reporting about the blessedness of just being able to finally become quiet, fully awake and alert, just finally becoming quiet. Just like that child sailing a boat who suddenly can just sit and watch. It's enough. It's enough. I always think of my wife is Jewish, and somewhere in the Passover service where people say, if we had only been given the Torah, it would be enough. What's the word for that? Dayenu. So, this Dogen Zen is even simpler. We don't even have to have the Torah or the scriptures. It's enough just to have a body and mind and to train it. Katagiri used to say, you've got all the equipment you need. You've got a body and mind. sit down, wake up. So simple that it's impossible. And yet we can work with this magnificent body-mind reality that we're right here in the middle of, and feel some of that wonder of being here. Oh, let me give you another of my favorite Dogen quotes. This is from the Bendowa. So this is about both Zazen and afterwards. When just one person does this Zazen, even one time, he becomes I'm going to get you ladies in here. The translator did not. He or she becomes imperceptibly one with each and all of the myriad things and permeates completely all time, so that within the limitless universe, throughout past, future, and present, he is performing the eternal and ceaseless work of guiding beings to enlightenment. Interesting. Sounds pretty grand. But just having a moment of calm quiet, maybe that's all it takes to change everything. It is for each and everything one and the same undifferentiated practice, one and the same undifferentiated realization. So we're not practicing to realize. As soon as we sit down, we're realizing. Making an opportunity. Just making an opportunity. Only this is not limited to the practice of sitting alone. We have to go, after tea here, out to our lives. The sound that issues from the striking of emptiness, that's our Zazen. The sound that issues from the striking of emptiness, each sitting is like the hammer hitting the han. The sound that issues from the striking of emptiness is an endless and wondrous voice that resounds before and after the fall of the hammer. So this striking of emptiness in a period of Zazen echoes out into our life. Our life, given even a little bit of spaciousness, can blossom. Well, that's enough of my talk. Any questions or comments or observation? Yeah.
It seems like there's sort of a, I don't know if you call it a tradition in Zen, of not really talking about the little steps along the way, as far as like, you know, little satoris, you know, the little benefits that, you know, it may not be enlightenment, but there's still stuff along the way. You know, even if it's just like getting that windsurfer on Calhoun, you know, moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, so I like that you're addressing this.
Well, you know, I think Tim and I were trained in a tradition where the only thing I was ever told for years was how to work with posture. Suzuki would come up behind me in sesshins or at the old Sokoji temple, and he'd adjust my posture. Never really told. He didn't even say, think of not thinking. He gave me the instruction to count the breath. Did he give you the instruction to count the breath?
He gave it to me once, and then he took it away.
Oh, okay. Right. Too much. Well, you know, for you, that was too heavy. Don't want to confuse Tim. So, but, you know, I think a great advantage, insofar as Tim and I have any usefulness, it's because we also have a whole Western mode of humanistic psychology, all of this stuff whereby the emotions that I never saw in San Francisco or in my years here up until the 80s, the emotions and all of that work that needs to be done with an emotional life was absent or very crudely dealt with. So now in Rinzai, you may get steps along the way. You know, we'll stamp you. You've had Kensho 1 now and come back next year and we'll work on. So the whole koan system, which I've never trained in, although Katagiri gave me a few at one point, I think that has much more of that step-by-step. Here's the program. But I think it's very useful. I mean, it's very bad taste what I did today, talking about, you know, kind of what's happening in my head. And, you know, normally, and there's a good reason not to talk about that, because if I talk about, oh, there's this samadhi of samadhis and you can be aware of awareness, then I give you this thing that you think about rather than just being in your own experience. And yet at the same time, without talking about it, I felt that I was hanging out there without much heartfelt support at times, because there was no tradition in Japan really of, at least that we were aware of talking about what is happening here. You know, I've sat 5 sesshins and I'm still just as jerky as I ever was. So why am I doing this? So I think it's very important for us in the West to use both the right and the left hand. We've got all of these tools that have evolved since Freud that are very important to making our lives work and our communities work. And that can, those streams can come together of the just quiet sitting.
I've never heard any of the Japanese mention anything about becoming aware of your inner dialogue and the negative or positive voices that those dialogues can have, you know, the effect they can have on
you.
Yeah. You know, being able to, oh, I'm saying my life sucks mantra right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And stopping it.
Yeah. And I worry a little bit about stopping it, but it's more like releasing it. Releasing it. Kind of, oh, okay, here's another my life sucks mantra pigeon. Go, you know, spread your wings, baby. And but then you may be covered with those pigeons. But at least we should be able to talk about it. I mean, it's no secret. And in the work I'm doing at the university, where there's a lot of attention to Jon Kabat-Zinn's work, there's movement. I don't teach this, but there's movement into cognitive meditations where you notice toxic thoughts and then you discuss them with a counselor or a therapist. And that can be very useful. For our purposes, if it's enough, it's enough just to know that they're, you know, recognize, oh, here's my mother. Here's that girlfriend who betrayed me in 1968. Here's, you know, the 10,000 thoughts and emotions that flood in. But we are so much bigger than any of those individual thoughts and emotions. So we can register that like waves on the Lake Calhoun. Sometimes we're tumbled in the surf by powerful thoughts, and then we have to wake up again.
I just want to say that as someone who has been exposed to and or appreciated you drawing parallel with like the because that there's that isolationism that comes with them that I think is problematic for people who live in have this sort of global awareness, especially in the United States. And so being able to draw the connections, I think, is really useful for people. It's encouraging people and then it gives them heart.
Yeah.
You're so global.
Yeah, and it's beautiful stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the first lecture I heard in 64 at Sokoji that Suzuki gave. He, in his very broken English, read pieces of the Shogo Genzo and the passage on the... I actually brought it here. Well, I won't read it, but the enlightenment which becomes lost and traceless because we're not attached even to our state of being so cool. And this tracelessness goes on eternally, forever. And just somehow the beauty of that image and language caught me. Had he simply read something from the sutras, I might not have come back, but he had a feeling in his presence too that was magnetizing. But yeah, we need all that stuff. And at the same time, we need all that stuff, but there is something unique, and I mean unique, one thing that this very simple practice of Zazen. No object. We're not looking to become Sufis and memorize Kabir. We're not looking to adore Allah. We're not even becoming Buddhists. We're just being here now. Nothing else. That's enough. So I tell my students this is the meditation of no assignment. No assignment. You don't have to honor Manjushri. You don't have to think about a certain koan. You don't have to detoxify thoughts. Just be here. Right now. Well, any other comments? Observations? Questions? Well, as Click and Clack say, you've wasted a perfectly good hour. So let's come to an end. How do we end? And Tim, thanks for inviting me.